I'm Lyle Troxell, and this is GeekSpeak.
Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and GPS. Purchase racist ads on Facebook.
Hello, this is Lyle Troxell. This is GeekSpeak, a show about technology and society and how they interact. With me in the air room is Miles Elam. Miles Elam is a programmer, father, and a general great guy. Hi.
How's it going?
Quite well. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
So now that Apple has released the new operating system, iOS 11, there's some oddities about it. Do tell.
Right now, with our phones, if you have an iPhone, actually Android phones in general, you have a similar item where you can say, okay, turn off Wi-Fi, turn off Bluetooth.
Mm-hmm.
This is usually the case with airplane mode where you should turn off. But there's sometimes cause for, you know, I don't want Bluetooth on right now because I don't want to connect up to my car, you know, things like that. Well, it turns out that in iOS 11, you can't actually turn off the Wi-Fi or the Bluetooth.
What do you mean?
You can click the icons.
Yeah.
You can turn off the icons, and that will disconnect you from your Wi-Fi network, for example, or will disconnect you from your headphones.
Mm-hmm.
But they will still be transmitting on, for example, 2.4 or 5 gigahertz.
See, the antenna's still hot. It's still doing... Why is it there?
I believe the idea given behind it, from what I've gathered, is that there are other things that it... There are other things that it can be doing. For example... with regard to Bluetooth, that's one of the technologies behind iBeacon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a technology where you have these little nubs around, for example, a store or a museum. And as you're walking around, your phone is able to detect, oh, I'm close to this particular beacon that has this ID. And it's able to look up and...
It also uses Wi-Fi networks to get better accuracy on GPS.
Yes.
It gives you warnings if you turn it off. So this is the from the swipe up on iOS 11 when you get that kind of control panel-y space and you can tap things from there. It's also a place where you would put your phone into airplane mode. In airplane mode, does it turn it off? Because the whole idea the FCC wants airplane mode is have their phones off.
That's a fine question. It's an answer I don't know.
I do know, thanks to Greg, who's listening in on the back channel, said that if you go to the settings in the control panel, the actual settings area, you can turn it off.
That is true.
And then it turns off the antenna.
But when was the last time you did that?
Well, the thing that I've always found frustrating with iOS devices is that you can't actually access your Wi-Fi control, Wi-Fi settings from that button that allows you to toggle it. So regularly, I want to toggle it, but really what I want to do is I want to switch networks. So I could toggle it, which doesn't help me, or I can go to the settings, open up the Wi-Fi, and switch networks. And it's always found it odd that you can't actually access the Wi-Fi network choice from that button.
Now I'm curious. Why do you want to switch networks so often?
What do you mean?
What's the scenario? It's something that I don't regularly have to do.
Oh, well, in the office we have our corporate network, which is slightly protected, and then we have like our public network, and then we have a special network that allows us access to regional access. Like if I want to have my device look like it's in India and slow network, I have to switch it there. So there's multiple access points in the same area for different purposes. So it's a dev issue. Here at the house, sometimes I'll want to switch between the 5K version stuff, but mostly, again, when I'm developing and working on things. And the last thing is, because I'm a Comcast customer, I have Xfinity, and I've signed up for Xfinity Wi-Fi, so I get access to those hotspots that are everywhere. Mm-hmm. But very commonly, they're horrible. Like, they don't work. So I connect up to the network, and it basically times out all my traffic. So I have to turn it off. Or if I'm in a coffee shop that has both, sometimes it'll preferentially choose the one that's bad versus the one that's good. So there you go. There's multiple cases of when I do it. So I find it a little disturbing. I mean, I guess it's not that big a deal if you can turn it off, but it is funny. Like, what are those buttons for then? Just disconnecting. Like,
well, it's the idea. I think the idea is, what is the intention of the user? The user, in many cases, is saying, I want the Wi-Fi here is bad, so disconnect from that Wi-Fi network and connect over LTE.
Right.
It's a curious switchover where, 5 years ago, it was, God, my cell coverage isn't very good. Let me get on Wi-Fi. And nowadays, you find the Wi-Fi at a given spot is kind of sketchy, but your LTE is noticeably faster and more reliable. So for the vast majority of people who aren't developers, that seems like a good choice, which is what their target audience
is. Except that another purpose to turn it off is, why waste the power? Like, turn off your antennas and you're doing better. If you've downloaded some content, or if you're, you know, reading some text that's already on your phone, just disconnect and you're going to save a lot of battery time. So that's another purpose to do it. But if it actually stays connected, it's probably not going to be as wasteful.
For Bluetooth, I can see that. For Wi-Fi, not so much, because when you're disconnecting from Wi-Fi, you still have your cell antenna.
Well, this is assuming that turning off AirPlay. Well, the other thing is, though, some devices, so for YouTube and Netflix and such, it's very common for people not to have cell on for them, but to have Wi-Fi on for them. So if I've downloaded content from Netflix, I can turn off the Wi-Fi completely. It's not going to use any of my data stream because I've chosen not to have it. And now I'm watching a movie offline and I'm not using any bandwidth and it gets to last longer rather than having the antenna on.
So in that scenario, why not just hit airplane mode?
Well, then does airplane mode shut it off? I'm assuming it does. But
I would assume it does just because
because I still want my wife to be able to call me. I don't want to be in airplane mode. I want to not use Wi-Fi and not use Bluetooth.
And again, your scenario that you've discussed is very much I'm a developer at Netflix doing something unusual.
No, I disagree. I mean, in the situation of I want to conserve as much power as possible, turning off stuff you don't need makes a lot of sense.
Hold on. I want to conserve as much power as possible while I watch this movie.
Hey, I don't need to have an antenna on. Right, it's power usage.
But what are the highest? What are the highest power usage?
Yeah, but the point is that I want to watch the entire movie, right? So therefore, I want to have the Wi-Fi off to conserve as much power as possible to do the important thing of enjoying my videos. So speaking of Apple, Apple has, of course, released the new iPhone 8 and i8 Plus. I saw them today for the first time. We have them in the office and all that. And they got some differences on how the buttons work. Now, it's been true for years that you can reset your device by using command keys, if you will. And it used to be, long ago, there was a switch on the side, and you would switch that switch on, off, and then you'd hold down the button in the front. And also the power button on the side for a certain period of time, and the entire phone would restart, reset. And it would get you to a point where you could actually reinstall the operating system and stuff. On the new iPhone 8, the process of the iPhone 7 changed. You had to hold the wake lock button and the volume down buttons, hold on to those for a while, and then it would restart or reset, right? But if you do that with the 8, it actually goes into an emergency SOS feature where it starts playing a loud alarm, and then it calls emergency services to your location. So not the best thing to do when you're trying to reset your phone. All of a sudden,
well, I'm assuming you would get the alarm, and if the alarm continued while you were still holding it,
I'm sure you could cancel it. Yeah.
So at least you get some warning, very loud warning.
So when you get an iPhone 8, you do have to do it a different way, and it's a quick press to the volume up, then a quick press to the volume down, and then hold the wake lock button for 2 minutes or whatever, and then you get the Apple logo. In any case, I thought it was kind of interesting to accidentally, if you're doing this, again, if you were a dev and did this a lot, it would be kind of funny and annoying. Let's move on to one more story about Apple, shall we?
Apple has talked in the past, and we've covered it, of how the phones are becoming more and more complex and they want to restrict who gets to fix them. This came into play with the thumbprint scanner because you have a secure enclave there. Just letting people go in and put new parts in is a security compromise.
Solution they had was basically disabling if that thing was messed with by replacing parts, they would disable the enclave and they wouldn't be able to trust it and you couldn't use that fingerprint scanner anymore.
Exactly. And unless you took it to the Apple store and had their repair process go through it and pay it double price basically for repair. Apple's position on this is that phones, or specifically iPhones, are becoming too complex to let you fix them on your own. Which,
did they actually say that? They actually recently
said that? At the same time, I go back and forth on this.
Except that a guy installed a new headphone jack in iPhone 7. So it's like, some
at great expense and great amount of time.
Sure, but some people can obviously do it.
Yes, and Apple does have a certification program for people to do it that would be certified resellers, not just Apple would make repairs.
Okay. So they do offer a methodology for other people to be able to service.
Right. But it is still along those lines of it used to be a lot of people would work on their car. And nowadays it's all computerized and you can't work on your car.
Unless you get a dealer that's been certified. Yeah. I mean, I'm mixed about this. The secure enclave problem is a serious issue, right? If you have anybody work on your device and they put in some kind of tapping system into it, you've got a problem. Mm-hmm. Or they, you know, cause some kind of security vulnerability.
And then so I have the thought process of like the iPhone X, which is yet to be released. It's almost, it was like some minor seals, almost completely glass. Glass on the front, glass on the side, thin aluminum thing on the, you know, along the edges. And I can see how, yes, they can't really be repaired by the mere mortal without special tools and the like.
Except that Apple's mortal. Like, I mean, the people that work there.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I also stuck with this notion of we're consuming $1,000 plus disposable goods.
Mm-hmm. Recyclable. You know, the other thing that's interesting
is that worried about breaking it. You can't open it up and use all the parts.
The iPhone 8, which already is out in the wild now and has glass in the back as well, the screen protection plan that you can get, which actually reduces your cost if you break your screen, the back of glass is not supported under that project. So if you break the back of your phone, then yeah, you're just out of luck. You've got to spend a lot of money to get it fixed. I personally don't like the idea of a glass back. There's no reason for it. I mean, the iPhone 4 had one, and it was really cool.
Well, transparency to radio signals.
Yeah, but really? I mean, seriously?
I think that's the reason why they did it.
Maybe. They just did it because they like doing that kind of stuff. I'm not convinced that it's a transparency to radio signal issue. But maybe. They just like glass. So too complex to fix them. Of course, not if you're certified and you pay them money. And then it's okay.
Yep.
I don't know if you've heard the story about Verizon deciding to kick people off their unlimited plan. Do you know why they kick people off their unlimited plan?
Because they're using too much data?
Yeah, because they're using too much of the unlimited.
Because they're like, oh, it's an unlimited plan, which means I can use the data. Wait.
So they recently notified 8,500 customers in like 13 different states that they'd be disconnected on October 17th.
Yeah, because 8,500 is a non-trivial chunk of people.
That's a lot of people. And the issue is that not that they're doing unlimited, it's that they're using unlimited in a roaming capacity. So cell phone carriers have antennas.
Okay.
Have antennas in lots of places that they own and have service in lots of places that they own. And then your phone can work kind of everywhere, even when you can't access the cell phone carrier's antenna. Mm-hmm. This is how like going overseas and stuff functions. Mm-hmm. And even in the States, some areas aren't covered by Verizon's equipment. And so they've made special plans that basically make relationships with smaller telcos that have cell services sites. And the reason why, of course, Verizon did this was to expand their network. Mm-hmm. So they don't even notify the end user via the screen that they're roaming. But from a perspective of a business plan, Verizon sees that area as roaming. Customer doesn't see it as roaming. They see it as Verizon because of the special relationship, specifically made so that Verizon could have a bigger network so they could be more competitive. So they are letting those people know, nope, you can't do this, and basically suggesting that they find a different carrier. Some of these areas, unfortunately, have no other carrier because though there's a system there, the only carrier on it is Verizon. Because of that, Verizon has backtracked a little bit, saying, if you can prove to us that you don't have another cell phone capability or that you're like a first responder or some other need, then we'll allow you to keep using this plan. But you still have to switch plans. You have to switch to a non-unlimited plan. And here are the different plans. And they go up to like, you know, $50 to $70. And then there's $20 line fee. And of this 8,500 customers, 19,000 phone lines being used. So these are being used at a heavy level for these people because it's their only carrier. It's their only service.
Right. Yeah. Rocking a hard place.
Yeah. So at least they backtracked a little bit and they're still supporting people, but obviously not the best scenario if you live off in the boonies and only have these as your provider support. Miles, we've talked a bit about GPS getting better and better and having high granularity and stuff. And you've got a new story about that?
This is covered from IEEE Spectrum, which is a magazine I always love to get for tech news.
We used to have them on the show every once in a while. Maybe I should have them back on again.
GPS chips are actually improving. This is coupled with the number of satellites, GPS satellites, is increasing as well. But right now, if you have, for example, an iPhone, you have maybe, if everything works out, 5 meters of granularity. In other words, you may be anywhere from right where it says you are to, what is that, 15 feet away?
15 feet away, yeah.
Give or take. 5 meters. Maybe we should stick with the metric system and
sure.
Pray to our metric gods. Now, this next generation, which is set to be released in 2018, so unless you're buying a smartphone that has this new technology next year, you don't have it right now, then you won't be able to take advantage. But if you do have that new hardware, it is expected to be about a 30-centimeter accuracy,
mm-hmm.
or in other words, a little less than a third of a meter.
I think we covered part of this story on our last live show. We talked a little bit about GPS and granularity. And then actually, over time, I believe the idea was that you can actually
We talked about it because there was a fuzz factor that was introduced, that a random generation, and then set up physical towers. You have you figure out what the offset is, and then you just fix for it.
So now they don't fuzz anymore. But the antenna, of course, you know, to get really good accuracy, you need to triangulate, and of course, the triangulation angles are not as good on smaller devices. So these new antennas, I'm assuming, these new systems are better and better at triangulation.
Yes,
of satellite systems.
That's so, cool. So 30 centimeters, or you know, for all of you imperial wonks, that would be about a foot.
You know, a good way to think about my physics teacher in high school always suggested that you don't try to translate metric to imperial. But instead, you start knowing certain metric sizes that just start to make sense. So you're about 2 meters tall. You're a little taller than me. You're about 2 meters tall.
I am under 2 meters tall, but yeah.
Sure. Okay. But you're about, like a tall male is about 2 meters, right? And that you don't need granularity. You get a measuring tape for that. But the idea is you start using, you know, things that start to make sense from a practical sense. You know, your 30 centimeters is about your hip to hip, right?
Mm-hmm.
A little bit wider, a little bit less, depending on your size of your hip, but that's about how wide it is. Mine's wider. You're smirking because you know mine's wider. You jerk. I saw your lips curl.
At that granularity, at 30 centimeters, that's good enough that I could, you know, walk around the perimeter of my house and get a pretty good track on that.
All right. Well, with this stuff in your phone as well could also help. The amount of distance you travel can also be measured.
Yeah, with a gyroscope on
it. Yeah. And everything Apple is doing in their new high-end devices for AR-type stuff, you need that kind of granularity for movement. So you can actually measure a room pretty well with an iPhone 7 and iPhone 8 even more so.
Not so much with the iPhone 5.
No, you have an iPhone 5?
Yeah.
You just bought a new phone, didn't you?
I did, and it is in the mail, and it will be here shortly.
What'd you get?
An iPhone 6S.
Ooh, fancy. What'd the S give you? The 5 had a...
It gives you a faster touch reader.
Oh, the Fast Touch ID, yeah.
Which replaces my iPhone 5, which had no Touch ID.
So you're skipping a generation. It also has Wi-Fi calling support, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. It has 3D Touch.
Oh, that's good. I like 3D Touch.
So I have no idea what 3D Touch is like, so that'll be a new experience.
It's not used as much as it should be.
And it has an altimeter or barometer.
Oh, I didn't know that. 3D Touch basically is just multiple sensitivities of how much you're pushing down. And I haven't seen a lot of great use for it, but it does have things like fast launches of applications. For like Instagram, you can hard press on the icon and like, you know, post that most recent video, things like that.
But the best part about it is that it's about one-third the price of a new phone.
Yeah, that would be a good deal.
So I'm very much the skinflint in this regard.
Is that what you normally do, is kind of get the cheaper tech?
I haven't. I actually got the iPhone 5 when it was brand new.
Was that when you were working at the Googles?
No, I got it before I went there. Well, the thing is, prior to that, getting a new phone wasn't so bad. Like, I got the original iPhone, as we segue onto this thing. Got the original iPhone. It was originally released at $600, I believe, was the price point. And then it was reduced down to $400. And then I got it when it was I got a refurbished model, so I got $350. So I was like, oh, okay, $350. I'll spend that much. I wasn't going to spend $600 on a phone, especially the first generation. Like, no one knew what an iPhone was really like before that.
I didn't know you got the first gen.
Yep. And then I got, you know, the 3G. The 3G was like, oh, you pay $200, you have a two-year contract. Okay. You know, and was very much like that. It was this $200 for the contract, along with that contract. And since I was planning on staying with the carrier anyway, sure, no problem. Then things started taking a turn. They stopped being subsidized. And I also didn't necessarily like the form factor to the 6 and the 6 Plus. I was kind of hedging.
You don't like the bigger ones?
Well, I'll see, because I'm getting a bigger one now.
I'm a Plus person. I use the Plus. But as we already declared, I have like more than 30 centimeters on hip.
But I mean, my big decision right now was, do I get a 6S or do I get an SE?
Because I really do like the small form factor.
I really do like that. It's funny because the things that I made the difference was not the screen size. Mm-hmm. The screen size, I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'll deal with it. It is larger. Okay, fine. But it was things like the SE doesn't have a barometer, and therefore it can't detect altitude changes going up and downstairs. It didn't have 3D touch.
Does that matter to you that much?
I mean, being able to examine how you're going, you know, how you're moving around in your environment, like, I was like, you know, another sensor wouldn't hurt.
Yeah. I use it quite a bit to motivate myself to go up and downstairs. So like at the office, I work on the third floor and there's elevators, of course, and they're fast, or there's a staircase, and the staircase is nice. It's got wood, it's got pretty pictures and all that. So I don't use the staircase unless I think about it. I have to like get my frontal cortex to involve myself to use the staircase. If I just move without thinking, I end up in the elevator because my body doesn't want to work. But I've noticed that with the reward system of the phone telling me how many flights I've taken, I can like keep my flight count up, how many flights of staircase.
Yeah, I thought about doing that.
That's very cool.
And without the alternator, you can't take steps. It's just forward motion, backward motion.
I didn't know that.
It's very limited.
I know it's alternator.
And the SE has a first-gen Touch ID, which means, and I know that like I go onto my phone, I turn it off again. I go into my phone, turn it off again.
I love the Touch ID.
So having it do faster is, you know, going to be a difference.
It was night and day. You know, I always upgrade to the most recent device because I work on the devices, so I always have the most recent. And I keep the gen before that with putting on beta software and devving on it. So I always have two devices, you know, all the time. Mm-hmm. One of them I use as my primary, the secondary I don't use as much. But I remember the separation between the S and the S, or the 6 and the 6S. These are both pluses. Mm-hmm. The speed of unlocking was incredible. In fact, you got so used to the old speed that you were waiting for it to unlock, and the newer one just unlocked immediately. I got to say, though, this weekend, I spent a lot of time in the wood shop, and I was doing stuff and had glue in my hands and stuff. And this morning, all my devices, I kept on having to type in my passcodes because my fingerprints were marred with little cuts and glue marks and things of that nature, mm-hmm. and the fingerprints weren't working. And I'm like, yeah, facial recognition would be awesome. So I am looking forward to the X.
It's Halloween.
But the X will be my next phone, and I am looking forward to the size being slightly smaller than the Plus that I use
now. The iPhone 10 is actually pretty enticing. Because it is closer to that
$1,000.
Yeah, because it is closer to that size. It's more enticing to me than the Plus sizes.
Yes. Well, you didn't get a Plus, right? You just got a 6S?
Right.
So it's bigger than that. I mean, both the screen and the physical size.
Yeah, but
not much.
Minimal. Like, you know, a millimeter or two.
Right.
Like
the screen size is a lot bigger.
Yeah, the screen size is on par with the area you get from a Plus. So that's.
I think that we're going to see it's going to be a long time before you're actually able to get the 10. That'll be the next one. I'm skipping the 8. It's the first gen I've skipped in a long time, but they're kind of the same time frame, right? I can't justify getting an 8 and also getting a 10. Mm-hmm. We'll have them in the office for playing stuff.
What's an 8 but a faster 7?
There's really nothing on. I couldn't convince myself that it made sense to get it. There's nothing on there that seems like it's really beneficial. There's a couple AR type things.
That and you're like, oh, maybe I'll get the new hotness iPhone 10.
Well, I'll definitely get that, yeah, of course.
But yeah, maybe I'll get an iPhone 10. In 3 or 4 years. Yeah, maybe 3 years. The price will be down enough. I'll be like, yeah, okay, I'll spend $400.
Let's talk about Microsoft, because we never talk about Microsoft. We're talking about Apple. Let's talk about Microsoft.
Microsoft, you know, obviously has their Office suite, and that's been moving to the web, so it's no longer based upon the Microsoft operating system, you know, not based on Windows. One thing that I've always wondered about was the database. It's one of the reasons why people get a Windows license, actually, is because they're running Microsoft SQL Server, and it only runs on Windows.
So SQL Server, of course, is the database engine of Microsoft.
Right. It followed a lineage of Sybase, SQL, and used a different language from the Oracle style, like Oracle
connection language.
Yeah, or an internal language, a procedural language. And in Oracle, it's called PLSQL for Oracle. PostgreSQL has something that's very similar to it, PLPGSQL. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's differentiated.
It's a model, yeah, a model off of it.
But many databases they use that model. Sybase and consequently SQL Server, use a very different one, which is Transact SQL. A very different syntax, slightly different operating model.
Sure. I love that you have to give its lineage of Sybase. I mean, Microsoft SQL Server, I mean, we've been doing this show for almost 17 years, like that, mm-hmm. right? And we've known each other a little bit longer than that. And when we met, we worked on SQL Server. You don't have to, like, Microsoft SQL Server has been around forever.
Yeah, but at the same time, I was thinking about it in terms of, like, PostgreSQL, the reason they had their procedural language look the way they do is because they were basing it off of Oracle.
Sure. MSQL?
MySQL?
MySQL, thank you. What does MySQL use?
Yeah, who cares? So, yeah, I'm sorry. I have a bias against MySQL. I'm not a big fan.
But does MySQL have a stored procedural language?
They have. You can write functions now. In the most recent versions.
They're really behind the time.
It used to be you had a choice. You could write your functions in C and then, you know, put it onto the system, or you could
not
have functions. They have since expanded it out.
So what's this new story with Microsoft SQL Server?
Hold on to your seat, because SQL Server 2017 works on Linux.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Wow, Microsoft is really changing. So you don't have to, so you can get SQL Server run it on a non-Microsoft OS.
Uh-huh.
That's a first.
You can get a Docker image of it.
And of course they have a licensing fee towards too.
Yes.
Gosh, it is more expensive than
PostgreSQL, obviously. And for
PostgreSQL has no license free.
Well, you can get a support contract license, with someone, but and MySQL, same thing. That
yeah, but it's not as expensive as Oracle.
But it's not as expensive as Oracle,
right? And it's backed by Microsoft, and it's probably really good on the Azure platform. So
right. You don't have to pay that really stupid per CPU license fee for Windows,
right? Which is totally insane.
Now it's just a per core for the SQL Server.
Well, at least you're not paying two. Here, I want to pay for a license for an operating system I don't care about at all, except for I can load my SQL Server. Interesting. I'm still not interested in running it, though. But, you know, teach his own. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me is Miles Elam. And this program is called GeekSpeak, and you can learn more about everything we talk about up at geekspeak.org. You can even donate to our program and support us and learn how to do that by going to geekspeak.org. To continue with our program, let us talk of Russian operatives.
I'm sure people have heard of this from other outlets that Russian operatives were using Facebook ads to further divide the U.S., basically inflame those who are already predisposed to be racist. It inflamed those tendencies to try to radicalize them. For those that were not racist, it tried to use language to try to direct the conversation so that the two groups were more and more at odds.
This has hit the news. It's been pretty common. I mean, pretty popular. Mm-hmm.
The reason I wanted to bring it up was not just because of that news that we have been hearing from other sources. It's that Facebook's ad stuff isn't a failure. Like, it isn't a hack of their ad system.
No, it's using their ad system to its desired effect.
Yeah, the ad system is working as designed. And this is the part that I'm really not okay with.
We've covered multiple shows on this topic about what Facebook can do. The more Facebook ads can do, what kind of targeting they can do. Examples of advertising to teens who feel worthless and sad. That was something you could actually do, the emotional state of teenagers. And we say teenagers, of course, you have to be, I think, 13 to be able to have a Facebook account, but definitely you can advertise those. I analyzed how you could do ads for our own program on Facebook and kind of was shocked at what you could do. And then, of course, we covered all those stories about discrimination where you could have an apartment for rent and advertise to only Caucasians, effectively, by, you know, choosing that interest group, if you will. And Facebook, of course, is
violating U.S. law,
and they had to stop doing that.
The person who was doing it, you know, who was setting up the ad, you know, they wanted to do what they wanted to do, and Facebook had made their system just so open and flexible without any real oversight that it was kind of a who's to blame? Who's to blame? And that's one of the concerns about a lot of this is there's a whole lot of. It wasn't my fault.
Right.
This isn't my responsibility.
And, you know, in the other places where people could write these kind of ads, it was like, what are they called in newspapers, the back of a newspaper? Classified ads. But a classified ad copy has to be received by a person and somebody has to put it into the paper.
Right.
And in that form, there's, you know, structure around it that it's clear someone's looking at it and potentially can get it caught.
Right. But and newspaper outlets were saying that people didn't try to do that anymore because they would just get shut down. It would just be like, no, it's not.
And we talked
a
bit about this of like, you know, if you found some different magazines that had different readerships, you know, let's say there was some Stream and Fish magazine that highly catered to left-handed people, right? Mm-hmm. And you only wanted left-handed people to rent your apartment, well, then you'd go ahead, you could place an ad there. And you're not doing anything illegal necessarily. Because just because that distribution of the audience of that magazine has a bent certain way, you choosing that as your advertisement spot is not necessarily illegal. However, when you're dealing with a structure and such that you can kind of decide who you want to advertise directly to in making your ad, then it becomes much more clear that you are doing a discriminatory act when you're creating that. So
over and above this, though, you have things like over the past, let's say, 40 or 50 years, you have an institutional change where society itself is putting in safeguards. You know, you start to learn where to look, where to try to tighten things up, try to follow that model to try to reduce, you know, for example, racism.
Mm-hmm.
And with a lot of the gold rush mentality of the web and apps and stuff like that, where we're throwing everything out, you know, the Uber model, which is throw out the existing infrastructure, try something new and see if it works. That you're also not just throwing out those things that were inefficient, you're throwing out all of those things that used to be protections for vulnerable groups and starting with a clean slate. And folks who felt constrained by those previous models suddenly had a green field to try it out again.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they were the fringe, like those are the ones who were going to try it out first and see what fit. And then once they learned certain skills, I was going to start disseminating out and start to move further out to the mainstream. Now, what is going to be the responsibility of these tech companies that have it? Like, what could Facebook do about Nazis, you know, right now, if they wanted to?
Okay, what could they do?
Right now, Facebook allows advertisers to target user-edited fields without validating the content. Like, you can just put in a value in there as long as it matches. There you go.
Wait, what do you mean?
The types of things you're looking for, the scenarios.
Okay.
When you put in a name and you put in a particular ad, you're finding an affinity.
Yes.
So you're able to have that affinity. Like, so the models that come back that say this ad is targeting ended up being blatantly racist tags. See if I can find.
So the learning system that would say this ad is for these people. No, is it the ad writing or the ad targeting? Meaning, is it using the system to say I want address, well, you know, white males between.
There is a feedback model where you're able to say, you know, this is, but yes, they were able to edit it so that it's, you're overlapping existing fields and then saying this is actually, you know, Nazi supporters, you know, or whatever. Ones that were put in there, but they were, it was very clear what the goal was, and it wasn't pretty. Now, the thing is, as a programmer, you're drilled in from very beginning, very early on in your education. And in as a journeyman programmer, if you didn't have a computer science education or computer information sciences or computer engineering, you know, formal one, you still had a very strong message of you don't trust user data. You always send it. You always validate it. You don't just trust it. That's where SQL injection attacks come from. It's that mantra is you don't trust users. You accept a wide variety of dirty data, but you go like, oh, okay, well, that's kind of loosey goosey. We're going to tighten things up as it comes in, but you don't just trust it.
Okay. How does this relate to making ads?
When you have these user edited fields that are, you know, someone can just put in whatever values they want without validating the content. I mean, that means you're not even checking to see, is there hate speech involved in these tags?
I see.
You know, what you're not looking to see, like, what is the intent?
So you can say, you can kind of in the system kind of say, I want people that are talking about, and you could type in dogs, cat, and pink bows. And then the ad's going to go to those kind of people that might have mentioned mm-hmm. those things recently. But you can also say, you know, hi, Hitler, and whatever kind of, okay. And then they're going to go to those people. So you're basically able to target people that the match or not just, yeah, well, the affinity of the ad that would be applicable would be interesting to you. And of course, this is exactly what Russia did in our mm-hmm. in our process.
Now, what could Facebook do? Well, right now with their ads, they can already detect ads that have what they consider too much text.
Right.
They don't want them to just be a wall of text. They want there to be something that looks like an ad. They want to keep that brand. So they're obviously detecting text. They're obviously OCRing.
Oh, you mean they can detect text in images?
Yes.
Okay.
So if they're already doing that, why aren't they also validating against racist memes?
I see. So, okay, describe a racist meme to me. I mean, in general, what you're saying is they take an ad, they put in the copy of the ad something non-offensive, something that Facebook's not necessarily going to tag as hate speech. And then they upload an image, and in that image is racism, hate speech, or even like a funny meme but has to also be racist.
Right.
When you say racist meme, I haven't heard that term. I'm assuming there's memes out there that are racist-based.
Well, you look for certain things, like, you know, the occurrence of the number 88.
Why is that?
H is the eighth letter of the alphabet. 88 is a commonly used term within the white supremacist
for Hitler.
For Heil Hitler. Yeah.
Oh. So I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So that's like a meme you're saying. You put 88 in there and then people that are in the know
well,
that it's for them.
That's an example of something that like if you see 88 in there that like maybe give it a little bit more scrutiny. Maybe that Bayesian spam filter kind of peaks a little bit higher uh-huh. that they're not talking about 1988, you know, that
unless they are.
Baby. Unless they are, and that's why, you know, like I said, a Bayesian filter to be able to say, like, here's the probability. So, yeah, it's a shame because that so-called ad scandal from Facebook isn't really a failure of the system. The system is working exactly as it was designed. And that's a problem.
It's not a problem for Facebook's bottom dollar. It's a problem for our society.
And that's why I consider it a problem. To say that a corporation has no public responsibility at all seems a very dangerous road to tread. Like,
well, I mean, this emerged in the 20s and 30s when newspapers had a lot of power and control. We'd started putting in some regulation on what could be said and how newspapers could be owned and monopolies of communication. It seems like those same problems exist in this day and age. It happens to be with Facebook and Google.
Right. Well, it's still advertising, but it's a new model for how to do it. That idea of being able to make those affinities, that used to be the purview of large marketing departments to be able to say, who's our target audience?
Lots
how do we
research,
do that?
Yeah.
How do, yeah. And that's so all being siloed within the, you know,
or it's
the open graph.
Or it's democratizing.
Right. That. But I mean, like, but it's within the Facebook platform. If you're not on Facebook, you're not getting those affinities.
Yeah, but at the same time, I'm a local hamburger shop in a small town of, you know, 1,000 people. I can tell them all there's something going on tomorrow with a sale or something, right? That's highly beneficial to a small business.
I'm not saying that it's not useful.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that it is not democratized.
Well,
democratizing means that,
but wait a second.
As opposed to, you don't have to have a full marketing department. That is true.
Okay, it's empowering a smaller business to do something a larger business could do in the past. That's what I've meant by democratizing. It's a bad term. It's not democratizing. It's lessening the cost for business.
Yeah.
What would you suggest from a perspective of a policy change that we could implement that would try to assess this? Because my concern is that we would hit this from a legal perspective with just a wet fish and wouldn't hit it well. You know, like it would just be a mess trying
right.
to.
This is difficult, especially because the U.S. has, you know, for example, very strict laws with regard to First Amendment that you don't have in many other countries. Like, for example, on Twitter, the Holocaust denial is a crime. Like, it's just,
in Germany
and in France.
Mm-hmm.
And if you tweet something that is basically Holocaust denialism, your account is banned from view in those countries. You know, Twitter is already doing that work.
Right.
But in the U.S., the U.S. government couldn't say, like, that's a crime, or not without a big fight with regard to First Amendment.
Yes. They'd probably lose that argument in the current state of affairs.
But Twitter is not the U.S. government.
Twitter could decide to do it.
Yes.
Right. But they don't. But they make the decision that it's in their best interest not to. And I would assume that if the laws didn't exist in Germany and France, it was still just taboo to do that there, but it wasn't legally required to do that, they wouldn't turn it off right there either.
Now, at the same time, the U.S. has made laws with regard to discrimination, like we were talking earlier about housing, with regard to jobs, it is illegal to blatantly say, I'm not going to hire you because you're black.
Right.
I'm not going to hire you because you're a woman. Those are now illegal. And it was argued in the past that this is violating my rights. This is violating my—
As a small business to hire whoever I want. Right.
Right. And that has since been struck down. I mean, that's saying like, no, it is within the purview of the U.S., upheld by the Supreme Court, that you are not allowed to discriminate against these people in this regard. So there is that avenue to regulate for companies in the tech world.
Yeah, and definitely we did see Facebook, pull the ability to advertise to only certain groups for housing, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So there are implementations in Facebook now that try to restrict and make that system fairer.
Right.
At the same time, that's not about speech. That's about services and limiting services and capabilities for people.
But I am, at the same time, a bit dismayed that these larger companies that are now established in these fields aren't taking a more proactive role in these fights. Because I'm not necessarily in favor of the regulation.
If Facebook knows what users are kind of white supremacist, pro-Nazi concepts, they could theoretically use their advertising engine to inform them of truth, right? They could tell them how—
Yeah, a wide variety of things, yeah.
You know, the facts around the Holocaust, things of that nature that might edify these people because they're in their own bubble. But instead, they're allowing the system to keep people in bubbles and making them happy because, of course, they stay more on Facebook.
Right. And now some people might say that that gives that company too much power once they start manipulating.
But they already have that power.
Yeah. Where's to stop them?
You're right.
Well, making a specific policy choice is different from what they're doing now, which is very much a this is generate revenue for us versus not. Although that is in itself a political choice.
I think that's a political choice. I definitely think that's a political choice.
But to have a sense of this is a social responsibility, how do we best meet those social responsibilities, even if they are just low-hanging fruit like we're not going to cater to Nazis? Like that seems to me like a very low-hanging fruit. Seems like a moral bedrock that you can work off of.
I am sure that Facebook has a level of core perspective that all people – they want to cater to all people, right?
Right now in tech, you have a very – strong misunderstanding between being polite and being oppressive.
I think what I'm saying is this. Facebook could choose to appreciate the majority of the planet, the 90 percentile, or they could try to get to 100%. And if they want to get to 100%, they want to make a safe space for Nazis to talk.
Right.
Because it's in their best interest to have everybody associated. If you lose some collection of people that are supremacist, whatever, mm-hmm. then you start to degrade the power that you have of everybody being on the service. So there's no benefit to them to not support crazy ideas except for the kickback of media insulting them. That's the only negative they have. So why would they do it?
There is a social pressure of someone says, hey, I want to invite this person. Sorry, they were already on the system and were banned due to racist speech.
I think that's not a good enough motivator. I mean, the people that would be banned would be like, yeah, well, Facebook's not for us.
No, I'm talking about the people who will be friends with them, people who are family members, people who say, like, I want to connect up with them, employers and stuff like that. That becomes this red stain, as it were.
Maybe now that Facebook has so much power, but I think there's still large groups of people that are not involved with Facebook. I know people that don't have accounts.
The thing is, an upstart company doesn't necessarily have all of the gravity, doesn't have that same power. I'm talking about the responsibility of a company
now.
Once it grows past a certain point.
Yeah. Well, I would rather them hold on to those customers and users, whatever, and start informing them better.
I mean, if white supremacists want their own, you know, social network.
White book.
Actually, there's one that's called Gab. That's where a lot of the white supremacists went after Twitter dumped them.
Gab?
Yeah. And
see, they're
having a hard time.
Almost one of the worst scenarios is that you get two different social networks. That's bad. You want to integrate people so that they have more communication, more interaction.
I used to agree with you. I vehemently don't anymore.
Okay. Well, so what do you suggest we do with a small population that might be growing that is supremacist and hateful?
Well, if they're growing, that's a whole other issue. The fact that they are ostracized from the general public, from the general group, I think is a feature, not a bug. Because that is what's occurred now. Like, for example, if you have a newspaper and you have a series of news stories that they are not catering to white supremacists and that the white supremacists might say, hey, if you ran this story, you would get more of that audience, and most newspapers are going to be like, what?
I don't care. We're not doing that.
We don't need your – and that's the thing. A corporation to be able to say, we don't need your business, that is harmful.
Mm.
And I wish there was more of that ethic within the tech community among the luminaries to say, you are acceptable to be excluded.
Who do you trust to make that decision?
And that's an open question. I don't have all the answers with regard to that. Right now, you know, who makes that decision for a newspaper? The newspaper editor.
Yeah.
Who makes that decision right now for Google? That would be Sundar Pichai. Who makes that choice for Facebook?
Zuckerberg. Sure. All right. Now for something completely different.
Sure.
I'm always curious about when it's the future. Every January 1st, about to be New Year's Eve, I contact my nephew on the East Coast and ask him if it's the future there, because of course it is. Mm-hmm. And I say, you know, do you have jetpacks? Do you have flying cars? And every year he's disappointed me. So I know we're not actually moving to the future. But this might change really soon in Dubai.
Dubai is trying to become the first city with flying taxis. Take your typical drone, scale it up.
I've seen these things.
So, you know, instead of a quadcopter, these are like octocopter, you know, four propeller or eight propellers, 10 propellers. And many of them, you know, they're looking at making them also driverless.
Of course. Wouldn't want to trust a human with one of those things.
Yeah.
Fully autonomous flying taxis.
That's what they're working for. Right now, you know, they're...
What's the timeline?
They're hoping to get them in the air by 2020.
That's soon.
That kind of goes along with the modus operandi with Dubai. Huge amounts of money. No regulations. And, you know, a lot of open space that you can try stuff out.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, a very good reason to have something like this is to get from point A to point B as quickly as you can to stay out of the heat in summertime.
So I guess we moved off the topic that I thought we were done with the racism Facebook thing, but there's actually more stories about this, specifically a bit of data behind racism, yeah?
Yes, I came across this online. There was, as is the case a lot of times where you're looking at a particular topic, and then some researcher comes out of the woodwork and goes, you know what, I actually worked on this a couple of years ago.
And I have data.
Yeah, I have actual data rather than, you know, random opinion. And it had to do with the general public and their attitudes given stimulus. I mean, so this is, you know, sociology 101.
Okay.
Or, I mean, sociology in general, to say, okay, we have this idea of someone who is protesting. If you ask a group of people of different backgrounds, let's start off with ethnicity.
Okay.
You know, ethnicity and gender. So white male, white woman, black male, black woman, Asian male, Asian woman. And you ask each of them, what is your approval or disapproval like of when you look at and when you see a protester? And they ask them when the protester was a white male, a white female, a black male, a black female, and on and on.
All right.
And seeing if there was a difference. And indeed, there was. The exact same scenario, exact same topic. The race of the protester mattered with regard to how they were perceived.
Okay, so you have a protest that's mostly of black men. And then you ask...
No, just take a photo, like show a portrait of a particular person who is at a rally.
Okay, so you show a snapshot of a rally with white people in it. And then you show that to a white person. And you say, was this an appropriate rally?
You'll get a more different favorable response.
Than a black. Okay, yeah. That totally makes sense. I could see that happening.
And they were doing this like peaceful protests, not riots.
Mm-hmm.
And they also did this based upon, you know, political outlook, whether they were liberal versus conservative, and looking at the differences there. And also looking at stereotypes, like what's the expectation of violence? And especially white people, you know, looking at black people, there is an expectation of violence. Even in the same exact same scenarios.
And this, of course, is a this is a study from the sources from 2016, cooperative election study. And it's Connie McGauley and George...
Corinne McConaughey.
Corinne McConaughey is the lead researcher from George Washington University. You know, so I'm just looking at one of the charts right now. Appropriateness of protest action by race, gender, condition, and respondent ideology.
Mm-hmm.
So they asked a group of white people. They asked a group of white conservatives. They asked a group of white liberals. And they asked a group of white moderates. And they showed pictures of people protesting black men, white men, black women, or white women. And clearly all of the groups, the appropriateness of black men protesting is less than of white men protesting.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, no, of white liberals, the appropriateness of black men protesting was more appropriate than white women protesting. So there's a bit of, yeah.
Yeah.
But the conservative one, black men and white women protesting were the least appropriate from a white conservative perspective.
Yes.
Interesting.
Now, with regard to that violence, this black men, and then considering black men more violent from that conservative perspective.
Yeah.
What you're looking at there is if you have news that is targeted to look at, for example, Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, a nonviolent resistance, but within a violent sport, the venue itself is violent.
I hadn't thought about the sport being violent. That's really interesting. Yeah.
It's a recipe to go to a specific political base. It's not an accident that it's in the news. That was chosen to be this lightning rod. And that is truly depressing to me.
Why?
That someone is crunching the numbers to figure out how to stoke racial animosity and to dilute civil rights protests.
Wait, why do you think that they're what's the claim here?
That the choice of a black football player as a protest against a very real problem, according to data, was not by accident. That was not a happenstance that it turned out that was in the news. That is actually something that when, you know, the president speaks of that in poor terms and talks about how he should never have a job and stuff like that. That is appealing directly to a specific demographic base.
Well, sure. I mean, that's why it was said.
Yes, but it's not just this is something that's liberal versus conservative or authoritarian versus permissive or whatever. It is very specifically targeting a racist tendency within the electorate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, it's not surprising.
No,
it's just.
I'm
saddening.
Sorry. I thought you were saying something edifying, and it just feels like, yeah, of course, that's what it said. It's a racist thing. It's obviously.
Well,
that.
Of course, I could say this, but when there's, it's a different thing when you go like, yeah, and I have the data to back it up.
Right. If you'd like to learn more about that study, you can learn more about it up at geekspeak.org. My name is Lyle Troxell. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence. It's used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so you can use our stuff any way you'd like. You can even make money on it. Just give us some credit. The title today by Greg Merkley is Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and GPS Purchase Racist Ads on Facebook. In the air with me is Miles Elam. And Miles, thank you so much for doing the show with me today.
Always a pleasure.
See you next week.